Okay, so I wanted this evening already to start our discussions towards Haggadah Shel Pesach. We have two Mondays beforehand, and then actually two Mondays without Shir. Seder night is Monday night, as is Isru Chag. And as we often do, I wanted to start with a matter that relates to Halacha and Minhag, and then we'll move into the Haggadah itself. And the halachic matter, of course, the two are so intertwined on Seder night. But the halachic matter that I wanted to speak about is that of Karpas. Okay, the launches the Seder, Kadesh Ochetz Karpas, and to try and get a sense of what are the themes and halachic themes, that is to say, and considerations. What's it all about? What's it doing? And what is it? Well, the source for the stage that we call Karpas, where we basically we take a vegetable and we dip it before for the Haggadah, and certainly before Matzah. The source of this idea goes as far back as the Mishnah itself. The Mishnah already tells us that immediately after Kaddish, we take this vegetable and we dip. Why do we do so? The Gemara explains. This is in Arvei Psachim, of course, in the 10th parak of Maseches Psachim on Daf Kuf Yud Dalet. And the Gemara explains that it's one of those things in order lasos hekera latinokos, in order to do something which is noticeably unusual. The children should notice it's unusual. That it's a little bit hard to standardize, but and they should ask. And therefore, apparently, already to be dipping vegetables before hamotzi wasn't common. And if it's done, so that's already something that attracts the attention and arouses the curiosity of the children. And indeed, this is mentioned in Manishtana, which goes back to Beis HaMikdash times. And one of the questions of Manishtana is Halayla Zeshtei Pa'amim, which apparently is unusual. Because we dip the vegetable into whatever it is that we dip, whether it's to salt water or vinegar, that's why we wash the hands beforehand. Because dipping food into liquid like water places it in the category which is called davar shetivulo b'mashke, a matter, a food which comes into contact with mashke, with certain liquids, and certainly water among them. There is a notion that it requires netilas shadayim beforehand. Now, some of us have never heard of that idea. In other words, we know that you wash before you eat bread, and that's basically it. But there is a concept of washing hands also before any food that is dipped in water or other type of mashke. However, there is a discussion as to whether this is halacha lemaisa nowadays, or, which some people say that it is, the Rambam holds that it's absolute halacha lemaisa, when if ever a person would take a vegetable and dip it into water, or for that matter, if they would take a biscuit and dip it into coffee, which is predominantly water, they would need netilas yadayim for tivula b'mashke. However, other Rishonim, Tosus among them, explain that the requirement of washing hands for tivula b'mashke, for something dipped in liquid, is only for the time of the Beis HaMikdash. But in our times, we are currently without the Beis HaMikdash. The only thing we need to wash for is bread. There is no requirement to wash for tivula b'mashke. And that's very interesting, because on Seder night, everyone does. So if you say that one always needs to, so then that makes perfect sense. This is a normal thing. You're about to dip your vegetable in water, so tivula b'mashke, you have to wash. But if you never do it, so why would you do it now? Or as the Taz borrows the expression from Haggadah Shel Pesach, Manishtana Halayla Hazeh Mikol Halaylos. Right? Why have people are never makbid about it? Why are they makbid about it now? But the Netziv, in his introduction to his Haggadah, explains very simply that the reason why those who are not accustomed to wash hands before food that's dipped in liquids is because they hold that this applies to temple times. It's a din for the Beis HaMikdash, but not for other times. But isn't it true that on Seder night, we do many things which are Zecher LeMikdash? And we do certain things that are Zecher LeMikdash as was done on Pesach. Korech is Zecher LeMikdash Kehillel. And therefore, even those who don't normally wash their hands before food dipped in water, Tivula B'mashke, but as a Zecher LeMikdash, and all agree that in Mikdash times, that is the halacha, and that is why that's part of the atmosphere, right? The Kedusha atmosphere of the Seder night as Zecher LeMikdash. What's very interesting is Reb Shlomo Zalman Orbach, Zatzal, he inferred that the indication of the poem, which we all say at the beginning of Seder, Kadesh, Orchatz, Karpas, also seems to communicate to us that the common practice is not to wash for Tivula B'mashke. Why? Because there are two washings that are mentioned in that poem. You have Urchatz, right, Kaddish Urchatz, and then you have Rachtza later on before Matzah. So before the Karpas, we say Urchatz. Before the Matzah, we say Rachtza. What is the difference between those two? Now, of course, it's a poem, and it rhymes, and Urchatz rhymes with Yachatz, and Rachtza rhymes with Matzah, but the rhyme can't be which dictates the messages within the poem itself. The difference between rechatz and rachtza is rechatz is a command. Rechatz means wash. Rachtza means washing. So Shlomo Zalman asks, when do you need to tell a person to wash? And when do you just need to say washing? It depends. If this is something that people normally wash for, you just need to say washing. When people, after Kiddush, when they go to wash, they don't say wash. They just say Netilas Yadayim. And everyone understands, yes, that the time has come for Netilas Yadayim. And that is why, before Matzah, it just says Rachtza, which means washing, because you just say washing and people know what to do. But before Karpas, people are not accustomed to wash. That seems to be more like the position that people don't normally do it. And therefore, if you want them to, you can't just say washing because they won't know what you're talking about. And that's where you need to say rechatz in order to tell them that even if it's something that they don't do normally, it's something they should do this evening. So it's very interesting that the diukim of Reb Shlomo Zalman between rechatz, the command, and rachtza, which is just the reminder. Just before rechatz, the only other command is kaddish, even though people make kiddush, but they don't do so until someone tells them to. Everyone is milling around until someone says kaddish, it's time to, we need to make kiddush now. And therefore, regardless of one's practice during the year on Seder night, we do wash, but we wash without a bracha, as we know. Now, thus far, we have discussed this stage of the Seder with its washing beforehand. But interestingly, the Gemara and the Mishnah never call it Karpas. And in fact, they never specify which particular food should be dipped or which particular vegetable should be dipped in the water in the first place. The Rambam, for example, just called it Yerek. And in the Gemara, it doesn't specify any particular kind of vegetable. The first time that it's actually called specifically Karpas is in this poem of Kadesh Urchas Karpas. That's when we first hear of it. Some ascribe this poem to Rashi, and if it's not from Rashi, it's from his Beis HaMedrash, from one of the Balei HaTosfos, so it goes back quite some time. But that, seemingly, is the first time that we see that of all the vegetables, one should make a point of Karpas specifically. And the question is, Why? Before we get to what karpas is. Manishtana ha vegetable as it. We call that vegetables. Why specifically would we go for karpas? So probably the most famous explanation as to why the preference for karpas is from the Maharil. Others say it also, but the Beis Yosef quotes it from the Maharil, Rabbi Yaakov Molin, one of the great Ashkenazi Rishonim, that there is a remez in the word karpas. And the remez is, if you look at the four letters of karpas, it has the letter samach and the letters of parech. And samach parech means the samach is the 60, the shishim ribo, the 60 myriads, which is the Jewish people, and parech is that they had their back-breaking work. Es vayavidu Mitzrayim, es b'nei Yisrael b'farech. So because of this remez within karpas, that's why there were many who advocated specifically to choose the vegetable, which is called karpas. And now the question is, what is karpas? What vegetable actually is karpas? And the two most likely candidates for karpas, one of them is actually based on a Yerushalmi. It's a Yerushalmi in Maseches Shavuos. And the Yerushalmi says that karpas is petrozilin. And petrozilin, petrozilia, which is parsley. And that would seem to be based on the Yerushalmi that karpas is parsley. The Maharil himself was of the opinion that karpas is celery. So these are the two candidates for karpas, parsley or celery. However, as we know, there are many different customs as to which vegetables are used for karpas, and the Aruch HaShulchan and the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch are already enumerating others, whether it's potatoes or sweet radishes or all sorts of other things. And therefore, you know, each household has its customs as to whether it uses what, strictly speaking, would be called karpas for the stage which is called karpas, or does it use any other type of vegetable. The only halachic insistence with regards to which vegetable to use is really which vegetable not to use for karpas, namely a vegetable that you could use for maror. It will short circuit things halachically if you take a maror candidate vegetable and already use it for karpas. But aside from a maror vegetable, all of the vegetables are okay. And the Shulchan Aruch puts it very delicately, I would say. He says that one takes, at this stage in the Seder, one takes karpas or yerek acher. Karpas or another vegetable. He's mentioned karpas by name, indicating that there is a preference of sorts, but also then said other vegetables as if to say there is no problem, and each family follows its custom in terms of what they are. What we do see is there is no absolute insistence as to which type of vegetable is used, but it does need to be a vegetable. It does need to be something that you'd make the bracha of ha'adama. And the question is, why? After all, seemingly one could dip anything. You could dip something that's charcoal. You could dip something that's ha'etz. So why is it specifically a vegetable with the bracha of ha'adama? And the reason for this is because there exists a circuit between the karpas and the maror in the following way. We know that when we eat the maror, unlike the matzah where you break the bracha of hamotzi and asher kedushanu al achilas matzah, when it comes to maror, we only make the bracha asher kedushanu al achilas maror. We don't make the bracha of ha'adama. And the question is, why not? And this really leads to the question as to whether maror actually needs a bracha or not. Normally, when you make hamotzi, it covers everything that's part of the meal. So now the question is maror considered part of the meal? And we can understand that the answer is yes and no. It's certainly not something that one would naturally eat in a meal, in which case it would not be covered by the hamotzi. You really actually should make a hadama according to that approach on maror, because it's not covered by the hamotzi. It's not a normal meal food. Having said that, Seder night is not a normal meal. And halayla hazeh, maror is absolutely part of the meal. The meal is not complete without it. And therefore, could it be because the Torah requires that you eat this, whatever it is that you eat for Maror, but the Torah requires that you eat it, that means the Torah establishes it as part of the meal. In which case, your hamotzi covers it like it covers everything else in the meal. So this leaves us in an interesting situation. Does Maror, in principle, require a hadama before you eat it? And because the matter is subject to machlokas, therefore, the way that we go about things is to take a vegetable earlier on. That's why karpas is a vegetable. That's why karpas has to be something that has the bracha of bari pri hadama, so that you should have in mind that if Maror needs, you're not going to make a bracha hadama on Maror, because some say it doesn't need it, but if it does, the bracha of hadama that you make on karpas should go on the Maror as well. And because we're looking to, so to speak, keep the bracha channel open of your hadama on the karpas to the Maror also, this is the reason why the Shulchan Aruch cautions or advises that one should have less than a kezias of karpas. Some people say that if you have a kezias of karpas, so then you just have to make a beri nefoshos, and then you broke the circuit between the hadama. It's closed, and it won't help you for Maror. And therefore, the way around that is to have less than a kezias of karpas, and that means that you will never make a bracha acharona. You'll never make your beri nefoshos. The hadama remains open until Maror. Having said that, the Shulchan Aruch does advise to have less than a kezias. And by the way, a kezias, when you want to eat a kezias, they can be quite big. But when you're looking to avoid having a kezias, they can actually be quite a bit smaller. That's the way it goes. But either way, whatever is one's working definition of how much a kezias is, it's recommended to have less. Some had the minhag of eating a kezias also for karpas. But the mainstream minhag, at least as far as possible, is to keep it to less than a kezias. There is one situation where, whoever you are, it is recommended that you eat a kezias of karpas. And that is if something happens which can only be, in the best of terms, be described as a catastrophe. And that is if you accidentally made the bracha of al netilas yadayim when you washed your hands for karpas, which actually is not so hard to do. Because when do we ever wash netilas yadayim without making a bracha? So it's a kind of a Pavlovian instinct, and it's a good problem to have, that whenever you wash netilas yadayim, you naturally feel like you want to make a bracha of al netilas yadayim. Of course, we don't do that. We shy away from the bracha on Seder night. But what if a person, and it can happen, if a person accidentally, quote unquote, made the bracha of al netilas yadayim? Says Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach, is all lost? Is it a bracha levatala? Not necessarily. Because there are some opinions that, getting back to our question, when you eat food that's dipped in liquid, tivula b'mashke, some people say you don't have to do that nowadays. Others wash without a bracha. But others say one should wash with a bracha, al netilas yadayim, each time, every day. That's the approach of the Rambam, that's the approach of the Vilna Gaon. Now, we don't normally do that, but if a person accidentally entered into that territory and did what the Rambam says you should do anyway, which is to wash with a bracha before you have your karpas, at least he needs to justify the bracha, so to speak, by having a kezias, because all agree that you wouldn't wash with a bracha if you're having less than a kezias. So in that case, in the interest of religious integrity, you should actually have your kezias, and with that to salvage the bracha of al netilas yadayim that you made. So we see how these halachic currents and forces and considerations, how they interplay with each other. Even if a person in that case had a kezias, he still wouldn't make his beri nefoshos in order to keep the hadama open for the Maror, as we said. It turns out, therefore, if we could say in summation, that the stage that we call karpas actually has three tiers to it, one progressively building on the other. In other words, the first idea is that one takes something, anything, a food, and dips it before, straight after Kiddush, before Hamotzi. That already fulfills the value which the Gemara called Hekeira, that it's not normally done, and that children will see it, and they'll ask about it. So the idea of taking anything and dipping it already fulfills value number one of Hekeira. Value number two, that item should specifically be a vegetable with a bracha of Hadamah for reasons of taking care of the Hadamah on Maror. So that's the second tier. And the third tier, for those who do so, is that it should be karpa specifically. Within the world of the vegetable kingdom, it should be karpas, whatever karpas is. And some people are makpid on that, other people choose whatever vegetable it is. We cannot leave, of course, a discussion, even a brief discussion of karpas, without mentioning something which really gives a completely new dimension to the whole issue of karpas. It's rooted in a number of sources, but I think one of the most famous is Rabbeinu Manoach, who is a commentary on the Rambam's Mishnah Torah. We know that there is an idea on Seder night of starting the story at the beginning. We say maschilim begnus, we begin with a negative, mesayim b'shvach, we end with a positive. We always start the story back, right from the beginning. And what is the beginning? Well, we would put the beginning as avodim hayinu b'paro b'mitzrayim. I mean, that's how it all begins. But of course, many good stories don't start in the beginning. They have a prologue. They don't start in chapter one, as if to say, how do we get to Mitzrayim in the first place? And the answer, of course, is the whole episode with Yosef and the brothers. If there is one entity that really was a magnet and summed up the tensions between Yosef and the brothers, it was the famous coat that Yaakov made for Yosef. And that coat is called Kesonis Pasim. The word karpas, which of course we naturally assume is a vegetable, and as we've seen, there are different opinions as to what that vegetable might be. But karpas has another meaning. In fact, it's a word that we've heard not too long ago in Megillas Esther. Chur karpas utachiles. And karpas there is a type of wool. I mean, these are the tapestries in Ahasuerus's feast. And Rashi, in his explanation, in his Perush on the Torah, in Parshas Vayeshev, in his explanation of the term Kesonis Pasim, which is Yosef's coat. And what does pasim mean? So is pasim the design? Is it what we would call stripes or multicolored or the like? According to Rashi, pasim is not a description of the design. It is a description of the material from which it's made. It was high quality wool, says Rashi, kagon karpas utecheles. Rashi invokes that pasuk in Megillas Esther, called karpas, because karpas and pasim are really the same type of wool. And therefore, says Rabbeinu Manoach, before we start to tell the story of Avodah Mayinu, we begin by nodding towards the events that got us into Mitzrayim in the first place. We take a vegetable, we go for karpas, or we call it karpas, regardless of what it is. And that is a zecher for the coat of Yosef, that karpas, and that's why we dip it in salt water in the same way that they took the kasonis and they dipped it in blood, and nisgalgalu hadvarim, and that is how things got down to Mitzrayim. So that is really a very an atmospheric marker in Seder night is the karpas, a zecher for the kasonis pasim that we dip. So that's quite different from the Maharil, who sees karpas as the samach perech, which is the remez that everyone quotes, elu ve'elu divrei Elokim chayim, and these are some of the classic discussions with regards to that stage in the Seder. So from there, let us come to consider the Haggadah itself. And in fact, there's an interesting question with regards to the name. It's called Haggadah Shel Pesach. Everyone calls it that. And what does it mean? Haggadah means a telling. Haggadah. What is the meaning of this term Haggadah? Well, some people say that whenever there's a discussion which isn't purely halacha, it will be called Haggadah. In fact, we're more familiar with the division of halacha and agada. Agada, which is basically non-halacha, everything which is not halacha, agada is really just the Aramaic of Haggadah. Often a hey from Hebrew will become an aleph in Aramaic, and therefore it says the Baruch Epstein in the Torah Tamima, in his parish on the Haggadah, any non-halachic discussion is called a Haggadah. The Haggadah for Pesach is called Haggadah Shal Pesach, but it really is the same concept of Haggadahs as we know in all other areas of Torah. Others say differently, closer to the theme of Pesach itself. And that is the source of the mitzvah to tell the story is from the word vihigadata lavincha. Vihigadata lavincha bayom ahu lemor. That's what makes it a mitzvah of taryag. Telling the story of leaving Mitzrayim is one of the 613 mitzvahs. It's easy to miss because we don't make a bracha beforehand. But it's one of the, in fact, in our times, there are only two Torah-level mitzvahs. At the Seder, one is telling the story and the other is eating the matzah. Everything else is derabana. And therefore, because the source of the mitzvah to tell the story is vihikadata levincha, it becomes called the Haggadah. Even though we refer to the mitzvah as Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim, we use the expression Sipur, but the title of the story is called the Haggadah after vihikadata levincha. And in fact, it's possible that the matter goes further still. The order of Maggid has perplexed many. It starts with the number of paragraphs, and then it talks about the timing, and then we have the story, and then Rabbi Gamliel's exposition of things, and then we're told that a person should see himself as if he came out of Egypt, and then it seems to move from thing to thing. Is there any way to understand the progression of Maggid? And this matter was discussed in the introductory essay to what is known as the Malbim Haggadah. Now, it's important to call it the Malbim Haggadah as opposed to the Malbim's Haggadah because there is a very good chance that it was not actually written by the Malbim. It's written in the style of the Malbim, the way that he approaches the psukim and very rigorous and thorough and clear and and so on and so forth. It's more likely that it was written by a great Talmud Chacham in the 1800s. His name was Rav Naftali Maskil Le'eson. His father, Rav Avraham Maskil Le'eson, is known for his notes in the back of the Shas, Mitzvah Eson, as well as many other things. So this is what's called the Malbim Haggadah. Haggadah's Malbim is the Malbim style Haggadah from Rav Naftali Maskil Le'eson. And he says, it's like a master stroke, which just then everything falls into place. If you wish to understand, says Rav Naftali, the order of Maggid, just go back to the Pasuk, which says, V'yigadata levincha. Because the Pasuk in full, as we know, is V'yigadata levincha. The Torah is telling you to tell your son, Bayom Hahu, on that day, Leimor, to say, Ba'avurzeh, for this, Asa Hashem li, Hashem did for me, Betzeisi mi Mitzrayim, when I left Mitzrayim. Says Rav Naftali, keep an eye on that pasuk, and your course for Maggid has been charted for you. The pasuk begins v'higadata levincha, which is the Torah telling you to tell the story, and therefore the first thing that Maggid does is that it discusses the obligation and the parameters and the various different children also, which means that we start by saying that afilu kulanu chachamim, mitzvah leinu lesaper, it's not about whether you know the story or not, right? As we say avodah mayinu, the background to this whole mitzvah is avodah mayinu, which is not yet the story. We're just saying this is the background to the mitzvah to tell the story. But we say even if we're all wise, etc., still a mitzvah to tell the story. We say kolamar b'lesaper b'mitzias mitzrayim harizim meshubach. The more you tell the story, the better. All of these are the mitzvah parameters, and then we move on to the Meiser Rebbe Elazar, the Meiser with all of those chachamim. We see how much they were engaged in the mitzvah of Sipritias Mitzrayim the whole night. And then we have Rebbe Elazar ben Azaria discussing the general obligation of remembering Yetzias Mitzrayim, Lo Zachisi, Koyu Mechayecha, the days and the nights. And then we move into the four sons, which is, again, all of this is Vihigadat Levincha, the Chiyuv itself. Next, Vigadat Levincha, number two, Bayom Hahu, on that day, which is the timing. And that is why no sooner have we finished with the four sons, we discuss the timing of the mitzvah in the paragraph, Yochel Mirosh Chodesh. Yochel Mirosh Chodesh, I might have thought that the mitzvah applies already from Rosh Chodesh. For whatever reason, I would have thought so. We've discussed that in the past. So the Torah says, Talmud Lomar, Bayom Hahu, and not only Bayom Hahu, specifically, B'shar Sheish Matzah Umoro Monachim Lefanecha. So the second part of Magid, which is about the timing of the mitzvah, corresponds to the second part of the Pasuk, Bayom Hahu, which discusses the time. Then, the Pasuk says, Lemor. Lemor means to say. What happens, what's the goal at this stage of Magid? To say, to tell the story. And that's why the story begins. It begins with, whether it's Mitchila of Avodah Zarah, or whether it's Tseu Lamad, Arami of Edavi. This is really the point where we start to tell the story. Okay, when we finish telling the story through those psukim of Arami of Edavi, at that point, we mention Rabbi Gamliel's exposition of the mitzvahs, right? Rabbi Gamliel famously says, whoever didn't say these three things, whoever didn't speak about these three mitzvahs, lo yotze yidei chavasa, Pesach, Matzah, and Maror. Why do we mention that at this stage? Because, says Rabbi Naftali, in the Pasuk, v'igadat levincha bayom ahu lemor, lemor is the story, and what comes straight after the story? Ba'avor zeh, for this. And for this is Ba'avor zeh lo amarti, ela b'shar sheish matzah umor, menachal mefanecha. The zeh within the pasuk are the mitzvahs. And therefore, once you finish the lemor part of the proceedings, you go on to the Ba'avor zeh part and discuss how each of the mitzvahs, what its reason is, why Pesach, why Matzah, and why Maror. And that's why Rabbi Gamliel's three things are mentioned there. That's the Ba'avor zeh. Then what do we say in Magid? As we're moving towards the final stages, that's where we bring in the idea, Bechol Dor Vador, Chayev Odom Liros Es Atzmo, Ki Ilu Hu Yotza Mi Mitzrayim. And what is happening here? Go back to our Pasuk, which said, V'yigadat HaLevincha, right? Memo Lemor, Ba'avor Zeh, Oso Hashem Li, this is what Hashem did for me. Every parent is to say that Hashem did it for him. That's that part of the pasuk, Asa Hashem Li, is the source of this special idea and a special mitzvah that a person should see themselves as if they came out of Mitzrayim. Asa Hashem Li. And finally, what does the pasuk say in the end? Betseisi mi Mitzrayim. And Betseisi mi Mitzrayim, which describes leaving, and that is where we go straight into Hallel. Right, which is lefichach, to give a hodah to Hashem, finishing with Betzeis Yisrael mi Mitzrayim. That's Betzeis mi Mitzrayim. So it really is a very wonderful way of making, you can borrow the expression, making Seder within Magid, because the Bal Haggadah, according to Rabbi Naftali Maskele Eson, the Bal Haggadah took his cue in ordering Magid from the Pasuk itself. Very special approach to this matter. So all of this is the Malbim Haggadah, that Magid comes from, that the word Haggadah comes from V'yigadat Levincha. I will mention, and I think once again, atmospherically, it will give us another dimension. The Abu Dharam, one of the classic commentators on the Siddur, and within that the Haggadah as well, the Abu Dharam explains that the term Haggadah is based on a Targum Yerushalmi. As we know, There are Targumim to the Torah, of course, first and foremost Targum Unkelus, but there are other Targumim, Targum Yonus and Ben Uziel, and there's also Targum Yerushalmi, and there are others as well. And when a person brings Bikurim, in Parshas Kisavo, the Torah states that he comes to the Kohen and he says, Higadati Hayom Lashem Elokecha, we would translate, Higadati Hayom, I declare today, I state today, Higadati Hayom, Kivasi Al Aretz, etc. And then he launches into Aramiya Vedavi. But on the words Higadati Hayom, the Targum Yerushalmi explains, Shabachis Yom Adin. I am praising on this day. The Targum Yerushalmi explains that the concept of Haggadah, Higadati, it's not just a declaration. It's a praise. Higadati Ayom L'Hashem Elokecha. I've come to praise Hashem. Because look what has happened. He brought us into the land, and he's given us the fruits of the land, etc. So Higadati is Shabachis. And the Abu Dharam suggests that is why, again, we take a lot of our cue from Seder night, from what happens with Bikurim. Arami Avedavi is all said in Bikurim, written there in the Torah. And therefore the whole Sefer is called the Haggadah. Haggadah Shal Pesach means the praise of Pesach. Haggadah is like the Yerushalmi said, Shabachis Yom Adin. And this really emphasizes for us how the mood or the theme that runs through Seder night, it's not just history. Knowing history is important, but it's important every night. And it's not even just education, which is also important every night. But it's a night of appreciation. The Haggadah is a process of Shevach. And that is why we've mentioned in the past, the Vilna Gaon is of the opinion, and as are others, that the four kosos on Seder night, which of course we're familiar with, Votsesi, Vitzalti, etc., as Rashi says from the Yerushalmi, but the Gaon explains that the four cups are correspond to the four things for which a person needs to give special hodah. Like one would bring a korban todah, or nowadays we would bench gomel. And all of them applied when we left Egypt. Those four things are, if a person was sick and recovered, if a person was incarcerated and was released, if a person journeys through the desert, if a person journeys through the sea. And all of these things happened to us when we left Mitzrayim. We were in terrible, life-threatening conditions there, no worse than the sick, no better than someone who was sick. We were incarcerated, we went through the desert, and of course, we went through the sea. And corresponding, therefore, to the fourfold obligation of Hodah, we have the Arba Kosos, Kos Yeshuos Esa, V'Shem Hashem Ekra. It's a fascinating way and very meaningful way to relate to the Arba Kosos every time we pick up another cup. Kos Yeshuos Esa, V'Shem Hashem Ekra, because that's what the theme of the evening is about expressing Hodah to Hashem. And that is the reason why we tell the story from the beginning. We have to start with a negative, because if we didn't start by remembering the negative or relating to, associating with the negative, we wouldn't appreciate the positive. One only ever appreciates something positive when one is conscious of the negative. If we're no longer conscious of the negative, we may be aware of the positive, but we don't appreciate it. But as a night of appreciation, you have to start at the beginning, the Gnus, in order to appreciate the Shevach. And moreover, that famous expression which the Mishnah says, Maschil b'Gnus o Mesayim b'Shevach. One starts with, which we normally translate, again, I think we have a natural reaction. So Gnus is negative, so one starts with a negative and ends with a positive. Gnus is negative. But Shvach doesn't mean positive. Shvach means praise. The Ritva, one of the great Rishonim, Rabbi Yom Tov of Seville, in his Perush on the Haggadah, explains, Maschil Lignus, you start with a negative, but where do you end off? Not just positive. Shvach means praise, right? You end off in a state where you give praise. That's what the evening is about. Exactly like the Yerushalmi said, that Higadati means Shabachis, I've come to give praise. The original Thanksgiving, as far as the Jewish people are concerned, is Leil HaSeder, with the Arba Kosos, and that's what Haggadah means, and Maschilim Bignus, Umesayimim B'Shevach. So these are things that are good to be mindful of. If one would ask the question, you know, what is the atmosphere that accompanies Seder? So I think the natural response might be anything between chaos and mayhem, as is the way, which also recreates, I think, and this is my benign interpretation, the atmosphere of leaving Mitzrayim. I'm sure it also was a little bit disorderly at the time, but emotionally, the mood that accompanies Seder night is the mood of Shevach. It's the mood of Hodah. It's a mood of Koseshua Sesa Uvashem Hashem Ekra. So these are some comments about the Haggadah. Generally, the word Haggadah and the structure of Magid, as we see through that pasuk, and let us now see if we can actually take a look at a piece of Magid. And we start, of course, at the beginning with Holach Ma'anya. And what do we know about Holach Ma'anya? Based on the Rambam, this paragraph is not, in a sense, in pure terms, it's not part of the Haggadah. That is to say, it was added on for the galus. That means when the Jewish people are redeemed, they don't say Halach Ma'anya. But when we were in galus, so that's when this paragraph was added on, and that's why it's in Aramaic, which is the language of galus. And we start by noting that our seder Halach Ma'anya, the seder that we're sitting down to, isn't really that different than the seder that we ate in Mitzrayim, on the face of it, right? And then the food that we ate in Mitzrayim. There we were in exile, here we are back in exile. This seems to be quite similar, until we see that it's not the same. And that's why we conclude, we say, this year here, next year in Eretz Yisrael, and that already is the difference between them. And it's important to realize, you know, what is the topic of Seder night? And as much as it's a very simple sounding question, it's important to state it, because formerly the topic of Seder night is leaving Mitzrayim. I mean, that's what the night is dedicated to. Having said that, the Seder is bookended by references to the final redemption. We finish Halach Ma'anya by saying this year here, next year in Israel. We start Nirtzah, which is really the end of the Seder, by saying the Shana Habav Yushalayim. So the beginning and the end of the Seder are about looking towards Yushalayim. Even though, formally, that is not the topic of Seder night. The topic of Seder night is leaving Mitzrayim. There are other festivals which are about getting to Israel. The festival of Sukkot is all about Eretz Yisrael. And Pesach is not. So we seem to be shifting topic. As much as we have these aspirations, and they are correct, but have we shifted topic from Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim? But it emerges that we do not shift topic. It really is an emanation of Yetzias Mitzrayim. Yetzias Mitzrayim was considered the root redemption experience, from which all other redemptions are branches. And therefore, if we really tap in to the fundamental geula at a root level of Yetzias Mitzrayim, so that itself should have us looking forward to Lashon Haba Ba'arad Yisrael, Lashon Haba Yerushalayim, because it's the very same energy. The more we reconnect with the root, the more we energize the branch, and that is the harmony, really, of the past and the future of leaving Mitzrayim and going to Eretz Yisrael, the initial redemption and the final redemption. That's that's how the two blend together. What is interesting is that our concluding wish of Halach Ma'anya is twofold, as we know. We say Hashata Hacha, Lashana Baba Arad Yisrael, this year here, next year in Israel. And then we say Hashata Avde, Lashana Baba B'nei Chorin. This year slaves, next year free. So what is behind this double phrasing? To what does each refer? And there are two approaches among the Mefarshim, either to see that there's a certain duality. But there are others who see that actually these two concluding statements reflect two different approaches to what exactly is our situation in Golus. And that second approach is the one that we'll take a look at this evening. It's from the Haggadah of Reb Shlomo Kluger. Reb Shlomo Kluger, who wrote prodigiously, so his Perush on the Haggadah is about 600 pages long, and he has 11 discussions of Halach Ma'anya. So we're choosing number 10 for this evening, and there's something about it, although it will need to be pondered further, but it will really open up, I believe, a very fundamental question. And he begins with a discussion that takes place in the Gemara, actually, with regards to Purim. As we know, we don't say Hallel on Purim. And the Gemara itself, in Maseches Megillah and Daf Yud Daled, questions this, after all. I mean, it's major Yom Tov, and you know, Chanukah we say Hallel, and so on and so forth. And it would seem to be a good candidate for the day, and yet still we don't say Hallel. So, why not? And there are a number of answers that the Gemara gives. Rav Nachman has quite a surprising answer. And Rav Nachman says that actually we do say Hallel on Purim. The reading of the Megillah functions as Hallel. Kriyasa zo halela. The reading of the Megillah fulfills the mitzvah of Hallel. Obviously, it's a very specific type of Hallel, but it is in fulfillment of the mitzvah of Hallel, additionally, that we read the Megillah. So when we read the Megillah, we're doing a number of things, right? It's the mitzvah of Megillah for itself. It's also the mitzvah of Hallel. It contains a number of aspects. That is Rav Nachman's opinion. Rava says differently. Rava says the reason why we don't say Hallel on Purim is because we can't. Conditions were not conducive to saying Hallel. Why not? Because how does Hallel begin? Hallelu Avdei Hashem. Praise, O servants of Hashem. Meaning turning to those who are servants of Hashem, Avdei Hashem, and telling them to praise Hashem. That's how Hallel begins. Hallelu Ko, Hallelu Avdei Hashem. The problem was, the nature of the miracle of Purim is that we were still in exile. Even after the miracle occurred, it's not that we were redeemed from the exile, we're still in exile. So we've been, the decree of extermination has been averted, and over that we have its own festival, but we didn't emerge from exile. Which means, in Rava's famous words, Akate avdei Achashverosh hanan, we're still servants of Achashverosh. And therefore, you're not yet fully redeemed from exile to the degree that you can say, Hallelu Avdei Hashem. So these are very, very interesting explanations given as to why we don't formally say Hallel. For Rav Nachman, we do, and for Rava, we can't, because we're still Avdei Achashverosh. However, says Reb Shlomo Kluger, if you think about it, it seems that Rav Nachman does not subscribe to Rava's idea. He does not accept Rava's analysis. Rava says, you can't say Hallel, because you're not Avdei Hashem, not completely. You're still Avdei Achashverosh. But Rav Nachman says, we do say Hallel. But how can you say Hallel? After all, you're still Avdei Achashverosh? Apparently, Rav Nachman does not consider us to have been in a state called Avdei Achashverosh. Even in exile, the Jew is not an Eved to Achashverosh. And this now, seemingly, is a very fundamental discussion as to how to relate to the Jew in Golus. What is he? What's his relationship to the so to speak, you know, ruling nation, to the host nation? For Rava, you're his Eved. in some significant degree. You're not fully free. But Rav Nachman says, no, you're not his Eved. And if you need to say Hallel, you do say Hallel. Okay, and Purim is a special type of Hallel. But there's no impediment. There's no impediment to saying, oh, you're not fully Eved Hashem. You are. So this is, it's what emerges is what we would call a hashkafic machlokas, literally a machlokas of outlook. The Jew in exile, with all that he goes through. And the machlokas isn't what he goes through. It's just how to define him in terms of how he goes through these difficult experiences. Is he considered an Eved, a servant to the host nation? Or no, he's a servant to Hashem. He's the host nation can make trouble and make demands on him, etc. But fundamentally, that doesn't make an Eved to the host nation. It could be that the question is, when we describe whether a person is an Eved, do you mean practically that he's beholden to them, or fundamentally, internally? From the time that Hashem took us out of Mitzrayim, there's room to say we're not internally beholden to anyone. And if that's if avdus is measured on the inside, so then that it doesn't exist even in Golus. If it's measured on the outside, there's more room to say that it does, because tachlis life in Golus, one cannot always act without due recognition of the hold that the host nation has on them. So here is the machlokas. The Jew in Golus, is he an Eved or not? And moreover, says Rav Shlomo Kluger, there's room to say that the root of the machlokas, as to whether the Jew in Golus is called an Eved Hashem only, or also an Eved to someone else, relates to a prior machlokas about Yetzias Mitzrayim itself. For Rav Shlomo Kluger, all of Torah is just there, it's available, just needs to know how to make the connections. We know that Golus Mitzrayim was forecast officially for 400 years. In the event, we were in Mitzrayim for 210 years. And there's many different resolutions with regards to these two different numbers. But significantly, they fall into two categories. Namely, is it possible to see the 400 years accounted for by the time we'd been there for 210 years? Or is it impossible and we just left in the middle? And there are sources for both. There are those who say that either the clock starts ticking from the birth of Yitzchak, which means there were 400 years elapsed by the time we'd been there for 210 years. Or others say that the difficulty of the work qualitatively packed in 400 years worth of subjugation into 210 years. All of these approaches have the same thing in common. By the time we left, we'd finished with the 400 years. Whereas, for the second approach, not so. The 400 years started from when we entered Egypt, and we were there for just over half of the 400 years, and we left early because we had to leave early. The difference between them is, which is a very major question, was there time left over from the original decree of 400 years, which would then exist in subsequent exiles? If we say the 400 years were finished with, so then any subsequent exile is a new enterprise, but it has nothing, these 400 years are over. That's a new term. As a later exile is a new term. But if we say that we left Egypt in the middle, so a subsequent exile can be seen as a supplement of and finishing off of the term of Mitzrayim. So, the one place where we were definitely called Avodim is servants in exile is Mitzrayim. Avodim ayinu lefar be Mitzrayim, and it was forecast that way. Va'avodim ve'inu osa. So we were without doubt had the designation of Avodim to Paro. So now the question is, what about subsequent exiles? Are we also Avodim there? Here, says Rav Shlomo Kluger, it could depend. If you say that the Golus in exile, the 400 years, were over and done with, well, so was the designation of Eved, which means subsequent exiles were no longer an Eved to the person in whose land we are. We're still in exile, but Avodim we're not. That was over and done with when the 400 years were concluded in Mitzrayim. But if you say, like the other approach, that the 400 years were not finished, so neither was the term of Avdus, and that can then bleed into and persist in later Golios, to yes, consider us to be Avodim. And when you think about it, That is the discussion between Rav Nachman and Rava with regards to Halal on Purim. Is there an impediment that we're not fully Avdei Hashem, or is there no such impediment? That is the question. But what we do see is that there are two schools of thought in this regard within Chazal. Says Rav Shlomo Kluger, so now we understand why Halach Ma'anya ends twice. Because there's really two ways to understand our own situation and then what we were hoping for its betterment. The first concluding sentence says, Hashata Hocha Lashon HaBa Ba'arad Yisrael. This year here, next year in Israel. It doesn't say that we're servants, because we're not. We're not slaves in Golos. Even when we're in Golos, we're not slaves. That's like the opinion of Rav Nachman. We are absolutely Avdei Hashem, even in Golos. We don't want to be in Golos, because we don't want to be here. We want to be there. But the transition for the redemption is not from slavery to freedom. It's from here to there. Hashata Hocha, this year here, next year in Eretz Yisrael. Whereas the second opinion more is in line with Rava. Rava says that as long as you're in Golos, you're still fundamentally or significantly an Eved to the person whose Golos you're in. That's what we don't want, but that's how we are. Hashata Avdei, Lashon Haba B'nei Chorin. This year we're Avodim, next year we hope to be free of that and to be B'nei Chorin. And I think this is a very appropriate place to end the first of our two sessions on the Haggadah, because we all know what it's like to be Mishubadim to other nations, not only in the diaspora, but even here in Eretz Yisrael. It's something that we feel keenly, and it's part of the Golos. That means in that respect, wherever we are, we have that element. We don't like to think ourselves as Avodim. We wish to be only Avdei Hashem. And I think that's really part of what we mean on Seder night, which is the night of freedom, where we say that to whatever degree we are beholden to nations of the world who have an unhealthy hold and on what we do and what we need to do, that is something that we hope, together with the full redemption, to be able to throw off in order for the Jewish people to be able to act the way they need to act. So these are part of the sentiments with which we launch the Seder, and we are looking forward to the fulfillment of both of them. This year here, next year in Israel, this year slaves to whatever degree we are, and it does exist to some degree, next year B'nai Chorin, only in the best sense of the word. So we'll leave it over there for this evening, Mitzvah Hashem, pick up our discussions on the Haggadah and Pesach-related matters next Monday. I wish you all the best. Have a wonderful week, and we should have Besuras Tovas, L'Klav, L'Efrat. All the best.